Our next case this morning is American States Insurance against Capital Associates. Mr. Shores.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Perry Shores, and I represent American States Insurance Company. In addressing whether a claim under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act for unauthorized transmission of facsimile advertisements is covered under the liability insurance policy in this case, we must examine two basic coverages, one, personal and advertising injury, and two, property damage. And I'll begin with personal and advertising injury coverage. One of the errors that the appellees, the district court, and other courts...
Before you address the merits, you might want to discuss appellate jurisdiction.
Sure. As far as the jurisdiction, there were two orders here, one that granted summary judgment to the appellees based on the duty to defend, and then the remaining causes of action that were based on duty to indemnify, bad faith, or rather Section 155, were then dismissed without prejudice on the grounds that all of those causes of action were premature and not ripe for consideration at this time. And based on the standards that have been applied by this court, in which jurisdiction is looked at in a practical sense rather than a merely technical sense, this is clearly a final and appealable order. And the reason for that is that there are no current claims that exist that are capable of being decided in the district court. There was no manipulation by either of the parties or the court to create appellate jurisdiction. And
why was this case dismissed?
The case was dismissed because there's no current basis for finding a cause of action for duty to indemnify, since the underlying case has not been resolved yet. There's no judgment to indemnify. Therefore, any ruling on the duty to indemnify would be premature at this point.
Yeah. You're not getting my question. Why was the case dismissed rather than stayed? There's one fundamental dispute among the parties, and it's got three manifestations: the duty to defend, the duty to indemnify, and if indemnification, the amount of indemnification. One of those three issues has been resolved. Two abide the event, in a sense. Wouldn't one expect that litigation of that kind would be stayed?
It would be stayed because there's the problem is that not only is it something that just ought to be stayed pending another pending further events, it's stayed that the duty to indemnify is simply not, there is no cause of action for duty to indemnify or the amount of indemnification until there's something to indemnify. And therefore, it's not just a matter of let's see what happens because this valid cause of action needs some other facts to reach judgment. It's we need further contingent occurrences to happen if there's going to even be a cause of action for duty to indemnify. It's very possible that...
So you think that both sides were wrong in filing pleadings asking the district judge to resolve this? I mean, this is a new tune, of course, because both the complaint and the counterclaims demanded that the district judge resolve the duty to indemnify.
But there's an important distinction. When an insurer says asks for a declaratory judgment that says there's no duty to defend, the automatic result of there being no duty to defend is that there's no duty to indemnify because the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. It's a different situation where an insured says, I want you to find that there is a duty to indemnify. At that point, you're asking not based on the duty to defend issue whether there's a duty to indemnify. You're asking, based on a judgment that hasn't occurred yet, is there a duty to indemnify? Those are two separate situations, and the Illinois courts have specifically, the Illinois Supreme Court specifically distinguished those two scenarios. You can find that there's no duty to indemnify based on there being no duty to defend. You can't find that there's a duty to defend and at the same time say there's a duty to indemnify even if there's been no judgment below. So those are two separate scenarios, and because we're in the scenario here where there's no judgment to indemnify, there can't be a cause of action for a declaratory judgment that there is a duty to indemnify because it hasn't become ripe yet. Going back now to the merits of coverage, personal and advertising injury. One of the errors that the appellees, the district court, and some of the other courts interpreting the offense, oral or written publication of material that violates a person's right of privacy have made is one in looking at that offense in isolation from the other offenses in the definition of personal and advertising injury, and two, in parsing out parts of that offense as if they were also in isolation. And I think Judge Posner of this court in Curtis Universal of Sheboygan Emergency Medical Services, which we cited, has correctly read that offense in the context of the full definition. In that case,
was that a concurring or dissenting opinion?
No.
Well, then it was a panel of the court and not Judge Posner.
Yes, it was a panel of the court. The opinion by Judge Posner, but you're correct.
It doesn't make any difference who writes for the court. Yeah.
In any event, that opinion stated a word sometimes picks up meaning from its neighbors and observed then that all the other terms in the list of wrong insured under the rubric of advertising injury concerned the misuse of information. And based on that, he also observed that the opinion observed that the invasion of the right of privacy involves the use of true, though misleading or offensive, information. And a TCPA violation such as this one is clearly not in the context of the use of true, though misleading or offensive, information. But I want to go a little bit further than just that particular holding there, because I think the context, looking in the context of the definition here, not only should we look at what all of the offenses have in common, but clearly listed as separate offenses, there's got to be something that distinguishes those offenses. And you have offenses such as false arrest, offenses such as malicious prosecution, offenses such as wrongful entry into or invasion of the right of private occupancy of a room, dwelling, or premises. If you look at oral or written publication of material that violates a person's right of privacy as purely a freedom from unauthorized intrusion or the right to be let alone, then the oral or written publication of material that violates a right of privacy is not something that's any different from those other three offenses. And really, I think what the distinguishing feature in that particular offense is the portion of that phrase, oral or written publication of material. And that removes mere physical intrusions from the scope of that offense. And along those lines, the court in Commercial Union versus Image Control construed Illinois as requiring that the alleged injury arise from publication in order to come within that offense. And in that case, therefore, the insured's acts of visually observing and interviewing the claimants were not held to be covered because the alleged injury was not caused by publication. And publication must be defined in a meaningful way. And in this case, the underlying complaint alleges that Capital Associates faxed advertisements to numerous members of a class. But Capital Associates would be potentially liable even if it had only sent a single fax to J.C. Halling, the named plaintiff in the underlying case. TCPA claims should be covered as personal and advertising injury only if the sending of a single fax would be covered as oral or written publication. There's really no basis for saying a TCPA claim ought to be covered if you sent it out to other people as well as the plaintiff, but not covered if you only sent it to the plaintiff. There's just no rational basis for making that kind of distinction. And more importantly, the term publication has to have some kind of meaning under Illinois rules of construction. And since material can't violate a person's right of privacy unless you transmit that material to that person, publication can only have meaning if it means something other than transmitting the material to the particular plaintiff. And therefore, publication has to be construed as transmitting the material to somebody other than the claimant in order to have any meaning. But the problem here is, and the problem that a lot of courts and appellees and the district court have had with this, is that they look at this in two segments, that there's you need publication and you need violation of the person's right to privacy. But that's not how the offense is written. It's oral or written publication of material that violates a person's right of privacy. And so there's a causal link that's necessary in finding that there was publication of material that violates a person's right of privacy. And it's really undisputed here, and it's never really been disputed by even the published opinions directly, that there's no causal link between publication and a TCPA violation, in that if an insured sends a unsolicited facsimile advertisement to a single individual or entity, that person is liable under the TCPA, even if he doesn't send it to any other person or entity. So publication clearly is the distinguishing factor here between just merely some sort of intrusion to the right to be let alone and something that fits within oral or written publication that violates a person's right of privacy. And then secondly, the right of privacy has to be defined also in a meaningful way. The right to be let alone has been often quoted in connection with the right to privacy, and specifically in connection with the constitutional right to be right to privacy. But the right to be let alone, that phrase taken to an extreme, could extend to any intrusion: battery, trespass, false arrest, sexual harassment, discrimination, and a multitude of other offenses. As a result, the right to be let alone is not particularly useful in this context. There has to be a line drawn somewhere. And the question is, where do you draw that line between just any old right to be let alone and what's intended by this offense? And in this case, in the constitutional setting, for example, privacy has been divided into two categories: avoiding disclosure of personal matters and independence in making certain kinds of important decisions. In the tort setting, privacy rights are generally categorized into four distinct torts. Now, it doesn't have to be within those two areas. Certainly, Congress has the right to further define the right to privacy. And, in fact, it did so in this particular case in the TCPA by defining a right to privacy based on the right not to be bothered by certain telemarketing phone calls. However, if Congress is going to define that right, it has to define it in a clear way. And in this case, it clearly was limiting that finding of a privacy right to the right not to be bothered by telemarketing calls. It did not extend to
any pending litigation in Congress. Pending legislation in Congress which would specifically denote faxes as a violation of junk fax as a violation of.
And if Congress passes such a law that specifically finds a privacy right and does it in a way that law is upheld, then certainly that would change the scope.
Do you have an answer for Judge Kaney's question, which is, are you aware of any pending legislation on the topic?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not aware of any pending legislation that defines.
I'll ask that of your opponents as well.
Okay.
My understanding is there is such legislation. There has been an attempt to add junk fax.
And if there is, then, as I said, that's obviously a point for a future situation where somebody would look for coverage under that particular legislation if it so passes. So anyway, I'm running low on time, but I think based on the overall approach of looking at this offense and looking at personal advertising injury, that this doesn't come within that particular offense, and I can deal with the occurrence issue on rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Shores. Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, John Hoffman on behalf of the appellee, J.C. Hauling Company. Unlike the other parties to this appeal, J.C. Hauling does object to appellate court jurisdiction, which I'll discuss briefly before turning the arguments over to Counsel for Capital Associates, who will discuss the duty to defend. It's J.C. Hauling's position that no final judgment or order was entered in the lower court, thus this appeal is premature and it should be dismissed. According to the case law, it's sometimes difficult to ascertain whether a order is final and appealable. And in those circumstances,
in your view, what is going to happen if the defense wins the underlying litigation?
Well, you would still have counterclaims outstanding at that point.
There's nothing outstanding at this point. Everything has been dismissed.
Well, the counterclaims have not been ruled upon. They are unresolved. I mean, they have to be reinstated at some point. I mean, Capital Associates alleges that American States acted in bad faith and breached its contract, not just by failing to indemnify, but also by failing to defend. That is actionable now. It doesnn't depend on any future contingencies.
I don't understand that at all. Aren't they providing the defense under a reservation of rights?
Well, yes, they are, but that is the allegation in the counterclaim.
So that's sanctionably frivolous.
Well, I mean, that
can't be.
That is the allegation. That is the allegation in the counterclaim that, as it presently stands, as drafted by Capital Associates.
The district court, I take it, failed to award sanctions before dismissing that claim.
That is accurate, Your Honor. As I indicated, sometimes it's difficult to ascertain whether a judgment is final and appealable.
Let me come back to the question: what, in your view, is going to happen if the defense wins the underlying litigation? It looks like that leaves the insurer out to dry. It won't reinstate the case itself. It doesn't have there's no indemnity claim remaining at that point. And it's lost on the duty to defend, but on your view, it can't appeal now, and it won't be able to appeal later because that will be more than 30 days after the entry of this judgment.
I am arguing that it could appeal then because
it's
have been
a perfectly
disposed.
Simple rule. You have to appeal within 30 days of the judgment. You
right.
can't appeal 2 years from now when events in the real world say there isn't going to be more litigation here.
I agree, but I disagree that there's not going to be more litigation here. The judgment is not going to be final until all the claims are disposed of. At that point, the 30 days will start running. And if you look at the intent of the district court in this case, which the Seventh Circuit has counseled that you should do, in ascertaining whether an order is final, I think the answer is unequivocally no in this case. The judge dismissed without prejudice. He called for the preservation of evidence. He called for the refiling of the case. He left a number of counterclaims and causes of action unresolved. He never referred to his order as a judgment. He never complied with the terms of Rule 58A. And I think if you're going to base this decision or try to divine intent, I can't see any action or statement by the district court below that would suggest that this was intended to be final. To answer your earlier question, Your Honor, why did the court do this? I think it was an attempt at maybe docket management or docket control. And I don't think there's any intent evidenced from the record that this was intended to be a final judgment. There are still claims outstanding. And once the counterclaims are resolved, once judgment is entered on those, which are not contingent, they could be prosecuted right now as far as the duty to defend claims go. Once those claims are resolved, American States can come back and appeal this and raise whatever issues it wants to address at that time, but not now. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Mr. Seltzer.
Good morning, and thank you, Robert Seltzer of St. Louis, on behalf of Capital Associates. On the jurisdiction issue, Your Honors, we believe that the case South Austin Coalition appears to govern this. It's obvious that the district court dismissed the remaining claims sua sponte. We had no part in that. District court pointed out to us that the scope of the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify, and probably rightly pointed out that it would be inappropriate at this stage to make a determination on the indemnification issue at this time. So we believe that jurisdiction is appropriate before this court. Regarding the issue of advertising injury, every single case that I'm aware of, and there are a number of them, that have dealt with the issue of whether or not claims under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act invoke advertising injury under the common language of these insurance policies has found in our favor, every single one.
How many of these are state cases?
State cases?
Mm-hmm.
I believe, Your Honor, from memory, a majority of the cases I have seen have been federal cases. The primary one that we've relied on is Prime TV.
Unfortunately, federal courts are attempting to predict state courts, and it's very hard to predict if you don't have any state courts. Are there any? I think there's one trial court decision under New York law. Any beyond that?
You're ahead of me, Judge.
Or are you just relying on more federal courts? All trial courts, it seems.
Well, Your Honor, since there are no decisions from Illinois on this, I think we're sort of in the same boat, whether we're looking to the decisions of a federal court or another state's state courts. We look to them for persuasive authority, and we look at their analysis because, in many cases, the law that they are applying is very similar to the law that we have here. Illinois law, for example, on the issue of privacy, there are four privacy torts that we can point to under the case law of Illinois. That's very similar to what many of the other courts have dealt with in this case. One of the things that I think I want to point out, and it's very important to me, is that I think it's beyond dispute that the rules of construction that would apply to an insurance policy, of course, require that terms that are utilized in the policy are to be broadly construed. And it was left to the insurer in this case to provide definitions for some of the terms that are important to the determination that you will have to make here. So, for example, the term publication is not defined. The insurance company embraces and tries, I think, to engraft upon that term its usage in some of the privacy torts that are out there. Three of the four privacy torts, for example, in Illinois, involve the use of publication of material to third parties. And thus they take that and they try to make the argument that, well, since there's no publication to a third party, therefore there can't be a claim that's covered under the policy. But the policy makes no reference to that body of law, and perhaps it's part of it, but we want to focus on the common usage of the term publication. So, for example, if we focus on the common law parallel to the rights that we think are protected by this federal act, intrusion upon seclusion. Intrusion upon seclusion at common law requires no publication to a third party. Merely bothering someone, merely intruding upon their seclusion, failing to leave them alone is enough. And in this case, the publication, if you're using that in a broad sense, is simply the transmission of material to a person who has...
What do we know about Illinois law? Has it said nothing on the question whether a term like privacy in an insurance policy covers every interest in seclusion as opposed to interest in embarrassing details? Right, that's the main rival, that the word privacy means secrecy rather than seclusion.
Yes, sir.
And that you put a word like that in a clause relating to defamation and advertising, you might think it involves secrecy. Are there any cases in Illinois on the question whether that word in a policy like this covers an interest in seclusion?
I am not aware of any application of that to a determination of coverage or construction of a policy. Now, Illinois does recognize a cause of action for public dissemination of private information, which, of course, doesn't necessarily
but
have
that's
to be.
An interest in secrecy.
Yes, sir.
You think there's no Illinois case law at all? Now, of course, that also means there's no Illinois case law in your favor.
That would be correct, yes, sir. In direct answer to your question, although there is substantial and overwhelming persuasive authority throughout the United States,
supporting state courts.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Are you aware of any proposed or pending legislation with regard to specifically including faxes in this?
No, sir, I'm not, but given your comments, I'm going to run to my computer when I get back to my office.
Well, if I had Judge Easterbrook's computer, I'd do it for you right now.
I appreciate that.
Actually, he's watching a movie, so it doesn't...
Excuse me?
I say he's watching a movie.
Oh, well, that's his prerogative. One thing that I want to focus on that I think is very important, there was a reference made to the Curtis Universal case where a panel of this court references what is described as a definition of privacy. And what I want to point out is that in that case, the court was faced with a complaint that alleged publication or transmission of false information, in other words, a defamatory claim. And what the court did in the opinion there was contrast the requirement of false or damaging information with the privacy torts that simply may require, in some instances, dissemination of truthful, perhaps, but private information. That decision does not in any sense purport, in my view, to provide a definition of privacy. And I think it's important to point out that in this case, we have to focus on the policy itself, which determines, of course, whether there is coverage. And the policy simply says that advertising injury can result from a violation of a right of privacy. And they don't define what right of privacy that is. And so it seems to me, again, under the rules of construction that apply to a policy in these circumstances, that means any and all rights of privacy.
Yeah, it looks like the Junk Fact Prevention Act of 2004 has already been passed by the House and sent to the Senate, but nothing has happened in the Senate, according to the Thomas website.
Well, my memory is not wrong.
I will be faxing a copy of that act to my client when I get back to the office.
Well, a copy of that bill.
Yes, sir, a copy of that bill.
Given where we are in 2004 and the fact that it hasn't passed the Senate, one might predict that at least the date in that title will never become law.
Yes, sir. If there are any other questions on advertising injury, I'd be very pleased to answer them. Otherwise, I would point out that the backup argument that we have under the policy that the court below did not reach was this issue of property damage. I will confess to you that the cases on construing whether coverage arises under this particular act, under the property damage prong of an insurance policy, do appear to be mixed. But the argument I would make here is that the Illinois courts focus upon whether or not the injury is an expected or intended consequence under the common language of these policies. And if you're focusing on the injury, then the question becomes one of subjective intent, it seems to me, on the part of my client. Did they know they were violating an act? Did they know they were violating the law when they sent this? Obviously, they vehemently deny that they did, but that will be for a finder of fact to determine at some point in time. But I guess the way I look at it is, you know, if a business maintains a copy machine and a telephone line and toner and paper, those are simply business expenses until you pass this act, which means that if somebody sends them a fax under those circumstances, then the cost crosses into a whole new area. It becomes a damage. And so that is what property damage, it seems to me, has to turn upon, is whether or not it certainly appears that we intended to send a fax. It would certainly seem to follow from that we would expect that someone on the other end would spend some minute amount of money to have to deal with the fax that we sent them. But then the question becomes, did we intend to violate an act such that they could be said to have been injured because of our actions? And obviously that is something that we think would support us, at least in the long run. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Selzer. Well, Mr. Shorish, you've probably got 30 seconds left.
Just a couple of points. First of all, I would just point out that the tort of intrusion upon seclusion in Illinois does not have a publication element, and I would just argue that's not covered under this offense. Secondly, on the occurrence issue, I think we have agreement here that the effect of intentionally sending a fax, meaning loss of use of fax machine, loss of paper and ink, is something that's expected and or intended by the sender. And there's nothing, the property damage that's expected or intended here is not violation or some legal standard. The what has to be expected or intended is the property damage, which was, and I think we're all in agreement on that. Mm-hmm. So there's no.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shores.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. Our next case.